This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Cleveland Cavaliers are facing the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals again. And you know the storylines. Hometown hero LeBron James fights for the honor of Cleveland. As for the Golden State Warriors...
Oh my God, they play with such joy. They don't look like a professional team. They look like a team that's just having fun.
It's like they're all playing as kids playing a game still.
They high-five one another. They always encourage one another.
And they're a great example for the kids.
But fans in the Bay Area also remember a time when the Warriors made headlines for different reasons. Here's reporter Matt Beagle.
This is the story of one of the most controversial moments in NBA history. It sparked a national discussion on race and violence and revealed fears and prejudice lying just beneath the surface of the sports world. But without this incident, the Warriors might not be the team they are today.
I'm David Steele. I'm the former Warriors beat writer for the San Francisco Chronicle.
When Steele got assigned to cover the Warriors in 96, they were coming off two losing seasons in a row and desperately trying to become a winning team again. The front office thought coach Rick Adelman was part of the problem. They believed he was too soft on players and let them get away with bad behavior on and off the court.
When they all of a sudden turned up one day and said, you know, PJ Carlissimo is the new coach, we're just kind of like, what?
PJ Carlissimo was a star college coach. He was young, energetic, and aggressive, but some of his former players said he constantly yelled and cursed, that he was borderline verbally abusive. It was a coaching style that worked with younger college players, but there were doubts that it would translate well in the pros.
But he somehow had convinced them that he was the guy who was going to whip them in shape.
The Warriors were banking on their new coach and a new attitude, and they built a marketing campaign around that.
It was called No War Mr. Nice Guy. There were billboards. There was a song that went along with it that started out with players singing Kumbaya. And then it would be the whole record scratch thing. And then...
No more, Mr. Nice Guy. No more, Mr. Glee. No more.
Carlissimo was all in on No More Mr. Nice Guy. He appeared on billboards wearing dark shades and a leather jacket, his arms crossed, glaring into the camera.
The fans were eating it up because the fans wanted to see a winner again.
20-year-old draft pick Adonel Foyle was also getting ready to join the team that season.
This is going to be cool. This is amazing. I can't wait for what the ride is going to bring.
The funny thing about Foyle, originally from the Caribbean, he may as well be named Mr. Nice Guy. Foyle says Carlissimo's style was rough, but that he was also nice, funny, good with the media. He just wanted things done the right way. His way. So, new coach, new attitude. But on the court, the team was still built around a holdover from the old franchise.
Plucked out of the air by Sprewell. Under a minute to go in overtime. Sprewell!
All-star shooting guard Latrell Sprewell, or Spree. Three things to know about Sprewell. One.
That he was exceptional. I mean, he was so talented. He can shoot, he can slash, he can rebound.
Sprewell was just electrifying. He was explosive. He never backed down. He was just a lot of fun to watch.
Two.
He was kind of volatile.
Writers and teammates say Spree could be reserved, emotional, and hard-edged. A few times he was near the center of drama off the court. He got into a few fights with teammates. There was a rumor one got particularly vicious.
And Sprewell going after him with a 2x4.
Three. Sprewell was cast as a team leader, but didn't necessarily want that role. Foyle says he would show up, work hard, then leave. There was tension between Sprewell and Carlissimo from the beginning.
By the time the regular season started, Sprewell stopped talking on the record. He was just not going to be able to say anything positive. It was a sign that everyone should have sort of picked up on.
The Warriors lost their first game, then their second, then their third, then nine straight. They weren't just losing. They were getting crushed.
This game is in the refrigerator. The door is closed. The lights out. The exit door.
It was depressing. I mean, from a player's perspective, just losing is just terrible.
Losing was definitely getting to Carlissimo. He doubled down on his aggressive style.
Get back, you know, push, pass, back, and just nonstop noise from the coach.
Spree wasn't talking to the media, but he talked with Steele off the record.
I mean, it was all PJ. It was just, he said, it was just really getting on his nerves, and he was just trying to shut him out, trying to tune him out, and didn't know how much longer he could take. He didn't want to, like, do anything like demand a trade or cause a scene.
December 1st, 1997. The Warriors, coming off a 5-game losing streak, held a practice at their facility in downtown Oakland on the 5th floor of the Marriott. The session had been closed to the media, but Steele and a few other reporters were allowed in for the last few minutes for what they thought would be a normal round of interviews.
We walked in, and players were shooting free throws, and it was pretty easy to notice that Sprewell was already gone. And PJ walks over, and he's got a, you know, polo shirt on, just like what he's been coaching in, and he's got these great big red marks around his neck.
Steele knew something serious had happened, but no one was talking. Even today, O'Donnell Foyle doesn't get into the details.
The practice started like any other and nothing unusual. And so I was in the middle of doing a post move when the incident happened.
Based on testimony from Sprewell, Carlissimo, and 20 other Warriors players and staff, here's what happened. Sprewell was doing a routine passing drill when Carlissimo told him to make better or crisper passes. Sprewell said he was. Carlissimo called his name again. Sprewell yelled at his coach, and Carlissimo told him to leave the practice. And that's when Sprewell lost it and put his hands around Carlissimo's neck. Carlissimo said the entire incident lasted around 10 seconds and that he was having trouble breathing. Both testified that Sprewell said, "I'm going to kill you." Teammates and coaches separated them. Sprewell went to the locker room, while Carlissimo somehow resumed practice. 15 to 20 minutes later, Sprewell rushed his coach again, swinging wildly and punching him in the chest and jaw. Again, they were separated. A league security rep escorted Carlissimo home. Oakland police were called to the gym to guard it in case Sprewell returned. He never did, though Carlissimo had a security detail outside his home for a week. Steele had only heard bits and pieces of the story by the time he was called back to the Warriors facility at 9 o'clock that night.
And the words kind of escalated to some physical contact, and then...
I was extremely surprised that it was as bad as it was. Really kind of blew me away, and I said, wow, he really did snap. That became a national story, like, immediately.
We probably went from three beat writers to thousands of reporters, you know, the day after.
It took on so many dimensions, and it took them on, like, instantaneously. And it was, like, honestly the dominant story in the country. Everybody had an opinion about it.
Articles noted Sprewell's imposing stature, his hair braided in cornrows. He was called a thug and a gangster. This is from Neil Rogers' show. A former Florida radio host, now inducted in the National Radio Hall of Fame.
Okay, but isn't it the truth that they play under tremendous pressure and emotion?
Oh, get out of here. Call one of the sports wimp shows, okay? They play under tremendous pressure, you jackass. Scumbag is a scumbag, pal. You can take the boy out of the city or out of the ghetto, but you can't take the scum out of the bag.
San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown made headlines of his own when he said that coaches shouldn't be yelling at grown players like they were kids, and maybe Carlissimo deserved to be choked. Carlissimo didn't want to press criminal charges, but League Commissioner David Stern was grappling with how Sprewell should be punished. There was pressure to make an example, because the NBA had an image problem.
Basketball was the sport that is harboring criminals and thugs and... people who don't obey the rules, people who are out of control.
Stern didn't grapple for long. Just 2 days after the incident, the NBA gave Sprewell the harshest penalty in league history for a non-drug-related offense, a year-long suspension without pay. Several other players in the league spoke out, claiming the penalty was unreasonable. Some even threatened to boycott games.
There was sort of this sort of universal idea that, yeah, he really stepped over the line, but I think a lot of people recognized an extreme reaction to it that seemed out of place.
It's always a picture of me looking mad or being aggressive. I mean, I never saw pictures of myself where I had a smile on my face. It was always negative.
A week after the incident, Sprewell held his own press conference. He apologized and admitted his actions crossed the line, but it was also a show of strength. Spree was flanked by a 9-member legal team, including Johnny Cochran, just 2 years after he defended O.J.
That sort of sent a signal to everybody that's like, oh, we're just not going to, you know, quietly and humbly accept whatever it is you're going to, you know, punish him with just for the good of the league.
The NBA Players Association appealed the suspension on Sprewell's behalf. The hearings dragged on for months. Eventually, an arbitrator deemed the initial suspension too harsh. Sprewell was barred from the remainder of the season, but was allowed to return to the league the next year. In his ruling, the arbitrator suggested that one day, Sprewell might even serve as a role model. Sprewell came back and led the New York Knicks to the NBA Finals that next year, but the role model thing never really panned out. He recently appeared in an insurance commercial making fun of his own reputation as a head case. Sports Illustrated's Chris Ballard says in the years following the incident, the Warriors front office deliberately tried to bring in, quote, high-character players.
There was this feeling of, okay, if we're not going to be good, let's at least be likable.
The Warriors signed veteran players without much upside.
And these were all guys you would want to have dinner with.
But that didn't equal wins. The Warriors didn't make the playoffs for another 10 years. Ballard says the nice guy thing only works when the talent is there, too. And in 2009, the Warriors found a player with that combination when they drafted Steph Curry.
Because if your best player plays with joy and your best player is not putting himself above the team, it's a lot easier to get all the other players to do that.
These days, the Warriors are known for their top talent and team chemistry. They're even able to absorb more volatile personalities because they're led by a coach who relates to and shows respect for his players. All of these attributes were learned the hard way, taught by Sprewell and Carlissimo, and a decade of losing following one of the lowest points in NBA history. As O'Donnell Foyle puts it,
the Warriors team of today had to go through the wilderness of desperation to come to find its true soul and its true purpose.
For Only a Game, I'm Matt Beagle.
I'd like to thank S. Franklin 1717 for the following iTunes review. Great show. I listen every week. You never know what kind of lesser-known sports event may be featured. And if you're particularly fortunate, it may be a Bill Littlefield doggerel week. I have bad news for you, S. Franklin 1717. This week is not a Bill Littlefield doggerel week, but I hope you'll still listen to the rest of the show. And yes, I say this every week, but please do consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review. It really is the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. This week, we're going to talk about back pain, the Olympics, and Mr. Met. My guests are Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Rachel, back pain is on your mind. I hope not because you have pain in your back, but you're on.
No. Thankfully, no. Not true, though, for two major sports figures. Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr has missed months of coaching and probably will miss the end of the NBA Finals with complications from a fairly routine back surgery he had 2 years ago. Tiger Woods has had four back surgeries, the latest one just weeks ago that he declared a great success. Days after that, however, he was arrested for a DUI he said was caused by a mix of medications, including powerful painkillers like Vicodin. And their stories really highlight this awful dilemma that millions of Americans face, and that is to treat chronic back pain with heavy-duty and potentially addictive drugs or undergo the knife, or what some people are faced with, essentially doing both. I'm guessing both of you gentlemen, like me, have either had serious back pain or know someone who has.
Craig, I'll let you answer that first. My guess is we're probably going to both answer in the positive.
Oh, absolutely. As a man approaching middle age who hunches like nobody's business and has bad genes, the back really, really hurts. And that dilemma, do you go under surgery or do you fall into the world of very powerful prescription drugs that is all over the news these days is a big question. And it's one that, you know, reminds me that all these athletes are people too, and they're facing a lot of the same hard decisions a lot of us are facing.
Bill Walton is one guy who comes to mind. He has acknowledged that before the radical surgery that finally eased his chronic back pain, he'd thought about killing himself. It was that serious. And he's not alone in terms of the depression and the despair that this sort of pain can bring. I don't know what else to say except that I really feel for people suffering as Tiger Woods and Steve Kerr have suffered, and my hope is that, like Bill Walton, they will find some combination of physical therapy, surgery, or some other route to pain-free living. It was great fun to talk to Walton recently and see how his life has changed for the better, and I can only hope that will happen for some of these other folks.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. Kerr certainly has said he's sworn off surgery. He had such a terrible experience. But the statistics show that several surgeries really are very successful in treating pain. So I think it's really incumbent upon everybody to just kind of do research and figure out what works, because there is no panacea that works for everybody.
All right, it's my turn. Of the five cities originally bidding to host the 2024 Summer Olympics, three have backed out. That left just Paris and Los Angeles bidding for the Games. And instead of picking between those two, the International Olympic Committee may choose both. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that the IOC, and I'm quoting now, is leaning toward a deal that would award the 2024 Olympics to Paris and the 2028 Olympics to L.A. If true, this would be the first time the IOC has named two Summer Olympics hosts at once. And I read this deal as a desperate move by the IOC. With more cities wising up, almost all of them, in fact, the IOC is desperate to lock in two major cities while there are still two major cities willing to be locked in, perhaps even enthusiastic about being locked in. We haven't heard from the populace yet. We sure did from the populace in Boston when it was time for them to scream. Or is there some other explanation for this two-city deal?
I think there's no question it's desperation. We've seen, certainly with the Winter Olympics especially, all the cities that have dropped out just not wanting the expense and the headaches. But I actually see a silver lining in this. I think part of that report was that LA is trying to leverage some funding out of the IOC in the interim to
deal.
Sort of agree to this deal. Exactly, the deal makers. And few people know this, but the 84 games in L.A. were, I think, the most financially successful ones, certainly in modern history. They produced a surplus that resulted in the L.A. 84 Foundation, which funds research and, I think, primarily youth sports. And so I would love to see L.A. parlay this deal making into some long-term benefit like that, or even just break even. At this stage, that might be the best we can hope for.
I would love to see this as the precursor to something that a lot of people have talked about would make more sense when it comes to the Olympics, and that is, instead of using a beauty pageant to pick a new winner every 4 years, you have a rotation of three or four cities or four or five cities that could host the Olympics on a regular routine basis. The infrastructure that goes into these things and the facilities that need to be built are what kills these cities. There's no reason why you can't use them once or twice, more than once or twice. Have these things go from LA to Paris to London to Asia to Africa and back again, and you might find a little bit more economic viability in some of these games.
I really like that idea, because then there would be fewer cities in which the poor would be persecuted, instead of alternating cities in which people are dumped out of their homes and told to move somewhere else far away from their work.
Less overhead in the persecution, yes.
Yeah. I think we have to be a little bit careful with financially successful games when we have to think about who they were financially successful for.
Yeah, I mean, certainly just producing a surplus would be something unusual for an Olympic Games. And also, I have to say, this is a double-edged sword, but generally speaking, the games in already developed countries, I would argue, produce fewer ill effects of the kinds that you're talking about. Not zero, but but fewer of them.
I'd say that's right. Rio being an excellent example of that.
Yes, exactly. And so that's another argument to kind of tighten the rotation.
Craig, the floor is yours.
On Wednesday night, the world-famous mascot of the New York Mets, Mr. Met, made some news when he flipped the bird. He flew the Freedom Rocket. He gave the Bronx salute to some fans at Citi Field. I guess the fans were taunting him, and Mr. Met had just had it. Immediately after that, and when it broke wide on the internet, the New York Mets announced that they were firing the man in the Mr. Met costume. But then something funny happened on Thursday, and throughout the day on Thursday, people felt a little bit of sympathy for Mr. Met. The Mets are having a terrible year. Things have just been going bad for them. And if you had to go into an office every day where things were going as badly for you as they were going for Mr. Met, you might flip somebody the bird too. It's going to happen. It's a very human and or mascot response. What happened after that is Mr. Met was not fired. The Mets decided to just reassign the man in Mr. Met's costume. And then even they, by the end of the day, were, I think, having a bit of a laugh with it. And I think the lesson here is that when sports teams and sports leagues go on to level discipline for bad behavior, it's not really about what's right and what's wrong or how bad ethically or morally the behavior is. It's about what the fans are willing to tolerate, how they react, how much pressure they put on the team and on the entity to do something. They felt bad for Mr. Met. They didn't care. And in this case, I think it's going to end up with a quasi-happy ending. And I think it matters very little when it comes to a relatively harmless thing like Mr. Met and his finger. But we should probably think about that when people are disciplined or not disciplined for a DUI or spousal abuse, or maybe when they're being blackballed like Colin Kaepernick seems to be. It's all about the fans' response and what they'll tolerate from a sports team, not necessarily what's actually going on in the underlying behavior.
Rachel, are you good with this extrapolation from the singular case of Mr. Met to the culture at large?
I'm not sure I would make that great a leap based on a cartoon baseball character, but I will say, Craig, you make a great point about the power of the public, and I think that's only increased in the age of social media. It's one of the upsides of social media, and the public called it right. This was a mascot misdemeanor. This was not a felony. I would say a felony is literally losing your head. A mascot taking off the head, that is the cardinal sin. He did not commit it. Therefore, he does not deserve to be fired. Mets made the right call.
I was astonished to learn that Mr. Met had a middle finger. I thought he was like Mickey Mouse.
There was actually a lot of debate about that. Mr. Met actually has four, so he doesn't have a middle finger. And the internet lawyers were trying to get Mr. Met off on a technicality here. But he also did the little cross-arm gesture you tend to see in certain parts of New York. So his intent was very clear.
So that was unmistakable. Did the lawyers defending Mr. Met wear big foam heads too? This would be a
big foam powder.
Yeah, this would be a courtroom scene without parallel, as far as I'm concerned.
It was the Philly fanatic standing up saying, "Who among us?"
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
Long before lacrosse became popular at private schools and colleges across the U.S., it was played by the members of various indigenous tribes throughout much of the U.S. and Canada. Long before. The game got the name by which people now know it from French fur trappers, who thought the sticks the Indians were using looked like the crooks carried by French bishops. Among many members of the Iroquois Confederacy, the game is not just popular, it's fundamental.
We're given a traditional wooden stick when we're born to sleep with in our crib. So that's when I got my first stick.
Jerome Thompson, like many kids on the Onondaga Nation Reservation in New York State, got the earliest possible start in the game around which he's built his life. Jerome's younger brother, Miles, was likewise introduced to the game as an infant by their father, Jerome Sr., who played professionally. Miles remembers step two of his education in the game.
The first memory that comes to mind with my wooden lacrosse stick is playing catch with my father. And, you know, he always tells us that, you know, he would never take it easy on us. He would always give us a nice hard pass. You know, he was my favorite player. That's who I watched growing up.
Lacrosse has a significance for the Thompson brothers. There are four of them, Jeremy, Jerome, Miles, and Lyle, that goes beyond a warm and fuzzy connection to a dad, even though he's slinging high hard ones at them.
There's always a story that, you know, we were told as kids that this game has been played since the beginning of time, that it began with the animals. And those animals brought a different perspective. And we were taught that these animals played to show that every child can bring something different to the game of lacrosse. because, you know, no matter if you're fast, you know, you're strong, you got good hands, you're going to bring something different to this game. Every child can play this game.
Maybe so. Maybe every child can play. But when Miles and Jerome were growing up, they didn't have a lot of options beyond lacrosse.
We didn't have electricity or running water until I was probably about 8 years old. You know, we didn't have PlayStation or Xbox. We had our brothers. We had our lacrosse sticks. You would drive down a res and you would at least see one kid with a lacrosse stick. And some of the days, that could have been us.
For the best players among those children with sticks, there could be practical material advantages, something in addition to the satisfaction found in following in the paw prints of those variously talented animals. There could be college scholarships. Several of the Thompson brothers got them. There could be something to hold on to while recovering from addiction. Lacrosse performed that function for one of the Thompson brothers. And there could be professional careers. All four Thompsons are currently playing pro. And as Miles Thompson explains, there can be something more important than all that.
My father, he taught us that the game of lacrosse, you know, we got to respect things. Respect the game, respect others, respect the people watching. Because that wooden stick was once a living tree. It's a hickory tree. That tree was living. We give thanks when we take that tree.
How many baseball players, even the best of them, feel that way about their bats? I wondered about that as I was speaking with the Thompson brothers, and a perhaps irreverent question for Miles slipped out before I could get a stick on it. What would have happened in your family if at some point you'd said, you know, Dad, I'd really like to play baseball instead?
I probably would have got beat up.
By your brothers or by your father?
Yeah. By all of them.
That's a pretty interesting question there.
Yeah, it is actually.
Interesting, perhaps, but beside the point, Jerome has also said of the game that it's medicine to cure sickness.
Our community uses the game of lacrosse as a healing. Every spring we have a medicine game that pretty much our whole community attends, whether you're a male or a female. To me, it's medicine in a couple ways. It's medicine for the players to be able to play it and go out there and have fun and play with a clear mind. And it's also medicine for the people watching.
Medicine, and at times, a sort of magic, or mysticism, maybe, of a cross-cultural kind. Until 1987, the Iroquois Confederacy was not recognized by the International Lacrosse Federation as deserving of inclusion in competitions with other nations. When the Iroquois did gain that status, thanks to a change in the Federation leadership, they began regularly competing with the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, and other nations. At the 2014 World Lacrosse Championship, the team from New Zealand honored the Iroquois as originators of the game, and Jerome won't soon forget it.
They performed the, they call it the haka. They did that for us. It was an unbelievable experience for them to do that. It sent chills pretty much down my whole back, down my whole legs. It was very heartwarming because they wanted to do that for us to honor the game of lacrosse and where it comes from. And we also returned it and sang a greeting song for them. So it was pretty cool.
We gifted them with an Alfie Jock wooden stick, and the leader of the pack, he actually broke down in tears when we gifted him with that stick.
The Iroquois national team, which included all four Thompson brothers, won the bronze medal in 2014. The game has kept the Thompson family tight, and their achievements have had an impact beyond the family and the tribe.
You know, it was much bigger than just for Iroquois nationals. All Native communities were supporting us, whether it was in Canada or the U.S. They were supporting us.
Jerome says another generation of Thompsons is already preparing for competition.
I have a son now who's 5 years old, and I know what he's done with his lacrosse stick. I mean, I got a almost one-year-old now, and he's crawling around with his stick too, so nice to see.
Nice to see, and more significant than nice. The success of the Iroquois team and their own achievements have inspired the Thompson brothers to spread the word. Sponsored by Nike, they run camps. Lacrosse is the draw, but the purpose is broader than teaching kids the game.
It's free for all Native kids. it's just a lacrosse camp to go out there, have fun. We teach them the roots of the game and what it takes to get to the next level.
And that's what the kids need, and that's who we're here for. We're inspiring the youth to want to do what we're doing.
Not every kid's going to be an athlete. Not every kid's going to be a lacrosse player, a basketball player. You know, some kid's going to be different, and he's going to be good in math. He's going to be good in school. Just find the love, and you're going to excel in that.
For Miles and Jerome and their brothers, excelling in lacrosse was an imperative. There were sticks in their cradles. But in that suggestion from Miles, that exhortation to find something you can love doing and then to excel at it, whatever it may be, in that there is hope that only begins with what he and his brothers have learned and accomplished playing a game. For more on the Thompson brothers, check out the documentary titled Spirit Game, Pride of a Nation. You can find a link to it at onlyagame.org. Bill Johnston was rising through the San Diego Chargers PR department when his wife got some devastating medical news.
I remember standing out front of our house just holding each other and crying because we didn't want to go in the house. We didn't want to face our children with this news.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, celebrating the 100th anniversary of Man o' War, a horse that often raced lonely because the other horses couldn't keep up. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NBA Finals began on Thursday night, and boy, did they begin well for the Golden State Warriors. Kevin Durant, 38 points, and they crushed the Cavaliers. So what do you think, four straight?
Well, I don't know. After last year, I'm reluctant to say anything, but it really does seem like picking up that Durant fellow was a fine personnel move.
He's pretty good at playing basketball.
Yeah, he's very good at playing basketball, yes.
Friday morning sports talk shows had a lot of speculation about what the Cavs should do in the offseason. Obviously, they're assuming the offseason doesn't begin with a parade. Too soon for that?
Yes, much too soon for that. I mean, I will grant you that Golden State has yet to lose a playoff game, and that Golden State looks like the best team in basketball. But they looked like the best team in basketball when they were up 3-1 last year, too.
A day before the NBA Finals began, a house owned by LeBron James was the target of racist graffiti, Charlie. James said in response, "No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know being black in America is tough and we have a long way to go." Have you anything to add to that, or has he said it all?
Except he's, in a polite way, reiterating Malcolm X's famous line about a black person with a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But also, gradually, and I think you and I have talked about this, he's becoming quite a spokesman and quite a public figure.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because he's talked recently about chasing the ghost of Michael Jordan, and he's lapped the ghost of Michael Jordan in this arena.
Well, pretty much, yes. I think he's going to wind up in politics, or at the very least, commissioner of the NBA.
Going into the weekend, the Pittsburgh Penguins held a 2-0 lead in the Stanley Cup Finals, and an article in ESPN this week suggests that the Penguins own Pittsburgh. I suppose this will not come as a surprise to the Pirates, but the Steelers may be miffed, or am I wrong?
Well, at the moment, they're not wrong, because right now, the Penguins have had a remarkable run of success. The Steelers can't seem to get out of their own way. I think Pittsburgh, for the moment, is a hockey town. And, you know, they've got one of the great young stars in the game and a terrific team. And right now it looks like they're on their way to the Stanley Cup.
Charlie, Tiger Woods was arrested on Wednesday on a DUI-related charge. Woods said he had an unexpected reaction to prescription medication, and that does seem likely as he did not test positive for alcohol. Jack Nicklaus has been among those saying Tiger Woods needs help now. Has it reached that point?
Well, I think so. Even if what he says is true, and it, apparently the evidence says that it is, his physical disabilities are obviously having a terrible psychological effect on him.
Since we last spoke, Frank DeFord, prolific sports writer, novelist, and longtime NPR sports commentator, has passed away. Have you fond memories of his work?
Well,
and of
him? I have enormously fond memories of the 18 months in which he was my boss.
With the National.
Yeah. You know, he was one of the most gentle and decent and humane people, certainly in journalism and probably overall, that I've ever met. And he was the reason a lot of us became sports writers.
The Jeb Bush-Derek Jeter partnership is no more. Bush has dropped out of the bid to co-own the Miami Marlins. But have no fear. Tag Romney, son of Mitt, is apparently interested. He's formed a group that includes former pitchers Tom Glavine and Dave Stewart. I wonder, will they have better luck raising the money than Bush Jeter did?
Boy, Jeb Bush just can't catch a break. There's always somebody in the way.
And nobody whose last name is Romney is going to have any trouble raising money, right?
I suspect not. I think, you know, Glavine and Stewart probably have a little socked away there, too.
Former major leaguer Ken Harrelson is probably better known for his 34-year broadcasting career than he was for playing the game. He says next year will be his final year broadcasting the White Sox. And you can put that one on the board.
I guess you can put it on the board. Yeah, well, he's also, you know, fondly remembered in Boston for the one great year he had in 1968.
And for being nicknamed the Hawk.
And for wearing Nehru jackets. Remember
That's
Nehru
right.
jackets?
I do. I never owned one,
even the Nehrus don't own them anymore.
Charlie, Margaret Court, she was a terrific tennis player. She beat Billie Jean King in a grueling Wimbledon final back in 1971, lots and lots of other tournaments. She made anti-gay comments on Wednesday, and now Martina Navratilova and others are suggesting that her name should be taken off one of the Australian Open's main stadiums. Yes?
I don't know. I mean, she's an icon in Australian sports. What she said was awful. What she said would have been retrograde 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm going to let the people closer to these issues fight this one out because it's really, really going to get messy. But I would probably vote to do so.
Last week, in a minor league game in Binghamton, New York, Hartford yard goat Josh Fuentes struck out, which is no big deal. But he struck out after the pitcher slipped off the mound and rolled a ball along the infield. With two strikes already on him, Fuentes took what appeared to be a practice swing, and the umpire said, "You're out." I wish I'd been at that game.
You know what happened? You know what's the worst part about it, Bill? Is that even after this embarrassing incident, he was still a yard goat.
It was a great day. Finally, Charlie, a goalkeeper playing for Figueirense in Brazil found a way to minimize his errors during a game on Tuesday night. At halftime, he called a taxi, got in, and went home. Not perhaps a strategy that's going to catch on around the soccer world.
Yeah, the really remarkable thing about it is it took 15 minutes for both teams to realize he was gone.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
When a sports franchise decides to move to a new city, we often think about the impact on the players and the fans. We don't tend to think about others connected to the team, the people who help put on the show. Only a Game's Martin Kessler follows two San Diego natives and the choice one of them had to make.
Michael Gelkin's first gig covering the San Diego Chargers was for the website of a local TV station. It paid $15 a story,
which barely covered my lunch whenever I would go to practice.
It was 2010. Gelkin was fresh out of college and wanted to prove he could make it as an NFL beat writer. After two seasons churning out stories at $15 a pop, Gelkin landed at the newspaper he grew up reading, the San Diego Union-Tribune. He was just 24 years old, covering the biggest team in town for the biggest paper in town, and he got pretty good at it. The job sometimes required bothering people well after dinner time, and this is where a guy named Bill Johnston comes into the story.
Working with the media, you know, it's 24/7. You know, I'll get the texts, but if it's a call, I go, oh no, now what?
Johnston started working in the Chargers Public Relations Department in 1979. Over the past 38 years, he's fielded more than a few late-night calls from Gelkin and other reporters about injuries and arrests, among other things. But starting a couple years ago, when Gelkin and Johnston spoke casually, the conversation often turned to the Chargers' potential move from San Diego to Los Angeles. The number one question, if the Chargers decide to move to LA, would you move with them?
Whenever I would ask, you know, he would quietly just say, you know, I'm not sure yet. You know, I've got some things to consider. You know, I got Ramona.
I noticed her immediately because she was a cheerleader, but she was very quiet, very sweet. I go, I got to get to know this girl.
Bill Johnston met Ramona back in high school. They both grew up in San Diego County in the 70s. Ramona was a year younger, the sister of one of Johnston's friends. When Johnston got his driver's license, he asked her out.
I think we went out on two dates, and that was the most she would put up with me.
Bill and Ramona ended up at San Diego State University. For years, they didn't talk much. Then, during Bill's senior year, they wound up in a class together.
I think it was a history of movies class, some bizarre kind of thing you just want to take just to pass. There she is. And all the times that I had asked her out over the years, I was determined I wasn't going to embarrass myself again and let her say no. So I kind of played the hard-to-get role, and eventually she ended up asking me out. 2 years later, we were married.
In 1985, they had a son, then a daughter in 88. Meanwhile, Johnston was rising through the Chargers' PR department, eventually becoming the director. Everything seemed to be going well, until Ramona started having problems.
She was noticing things mentally she couldn't remember how to do, things that used to come so easy for her, or just a train of thought. She would lose her ability to focus.
Johnston says his wife sometimes couldn't come up with the words she wanted.
She also started having a lot of car accidents. I mean, she was never hurt in the car accident, but our cars sure took a beating. But we both agreed it was time to go see a doctor, and she was very excited about that to see what was wrong with her. She had no idea.
This was early 1999. For the next few months, the Johnstons visited doctors. No one could figure it out. Finally, after about 6 months, one doctor said he had an idea.
He was hesitant to tell us what he thought, and then we basically pried it out of him, and he said, well, I think it's Huntington's disease. And at the time, we both kind of looked at each other and says, oh, okay, really? Okay. And it was almost like a little bit of a sign of relief, because it was the first time someone had actually said what they thought could be the problem.
The doctor told Ramona to take a blood test, and then the Johnstons went home.
And I said, all right, Huntington's disease, what is this? I got to look this up. And you go online and you read about it. And I just said, my heart just dropped because I'm reading the words, you know, no cure. I'm reading degenerative. And then I'm reading it's a genetic disease where it could be passed down to your children, a 50-50 chance that your children could inherit this gene and this disease. So it was a scary time.
The results from the blood test came in. Ramona had Huntington's.
I remember standing out front of our house at the time, both of us just holding each other and crying because we didn't want to go in the house. We didn't want to face our children with this news. And that was probably the hardest, one of the hardest days of our lives.
The Johnstons tried to adjust. When climbing stairs became too difficult for Ramona, Bill converted a first-floor room into a bedroom. Huntington's breaks down nerve cells in the brain, and as Ramona lost more control of her muscles, she moved into an assisted living home, then a skilled nursing home. For the past few years, she's needed a feeding tube. She can no longer walk or talk. Meanwhile, Bill Johnston developed a daily routine.
I see her every morning because she's more alert in the morning. So I usually get there about 5:30. They've got her up and watching TV. And so I come in, I'll sit and we'll talk, or I will do all the talking, obviously. And I'll talk to her as if she knows and understands every word I'm saying. I don't know if she does.
Johnston tells his wife about his plan for the day, the latest on their children.
I'll just try to talk to her and like I would if we were sitting around a breakfast table at home.
Before he leaves, he turns on one of Ramona's favorite movies. Nurses switch them out throughout the day. Then Johnston goes to the gym or on a run. He runs marathons to raise money for Huntington's disease research, and then he heads to work. On Fridays, he buys 2 boxes of donuts, one for his colleagues with the Chargers and one for Ramona's nurses. For years, that's been his life. Then in January, the Chargers announced that the move to LA was going to happen. The team's employees had to decide whether they wanted to go with the team. So Johnston made some trips to LA. He was looking for a new nursing home. It would have to be in Orange County, in the same neighborhood as the Chargers' future office, so he could still see his wife every morning before work. He visited 7 different facilities.
It didn't take me long to realize that there wasn't anything like what my wife had here in San Diego. I trust the people where she is, and I just came to the realization that for her to have the best care and for me to have peace of mind, it was best for everyone if I didn't go with the team.
When reporter Michael Gelkin learned of Johnston's decision, he had a request for the longtime PR director. He wanted to tell Johnston's story in the San Diego Union-Tribune. Johnston says his initial reaction was no. He always believed it was his role to be behind the scenes. But he thought about it, and eventually he agreed. So Gelkin and Johnston met at a coffee shop in Mission Valley, and Johnston told Gelkin all about his life with Ramona and his decision to stay in San Diego.
As a reporter, you start thinking, man, I really got to tell the story, and I need to tell the story. And then 2 days later, on Monday morning, I received a phone call from my editor-in-chief, a phone call that I was sort of expecting at some point. The phone call was, you know, with the Chargers having moved from San Diego to Los Angeles, and us being a San Diego newspaper, we're going to be dissolving your position. I told my editor, I said, Jay, I'm only going to ask for one favor in all this. He said, what's that? And I said, you got to let me tell Bill Johnston's story. People in San Diego need to know that, you know, he's up for hire. And he said, okay.
So Michael Gelkin's final article for the San Diego Union-Tribune ran 3 days after his last day on the job. It was the story of Bill and Ramona Johnston. The headline, Love Keeps Longtime Chargers PR Director at Home. It ended like this.
He knows he'll find comfort in the belief that while he's in the office, Ramona is there, receiving the best possible care. San Diego is home for her. San Diego is home for him.
I started hearing from people, just a lot of people saying congratulations on the decision. A lot of people were saying, I'm sorry to hear it. And then a lot of, you know, I was getting some people asking, well, when might you be available? Would you be interested in this or that?
Johnston says he hasn't yet settled on his next job, but he feels good knowing there are opportunities that will keep him near his wife. He'll also be near his 2 children. They're both adults now living in San Diego. Johnston's son has gotten tested for the disease. He doesn't have it. Johnston's daughter has decided not to get tested. Michael Gelkin has already found a new job. Last month, he started covering the Raiders for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He says he will keep in touch with Johnston, though he no longer plans to bother him after dinner.
There'll be more of those afternoon, morning check-ins, but yes, I definitely am confident that Bill and I will keep in touch.
That's journalist Michael Gelkin talking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. You can link to Gelkin's story about Bill and Ramona Johnston at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Bill Johnston, who explains the deep philosophical reasons why he became friends with his future wife's brother.
They had a pool, obviously. If somebody had a pool, they were going to be your friend. You'd figure out a way.
Okay, so don't feel bad about those rising tides creating a pool in your backyard, right? It's just an opportunity to make new friends. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports and PR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.